Right, I'm going to do them all again now. This is the TV Booth Podcast.
Hello, it's Rob Francis here. Thank you for downloading this special compilation edition of the TV Booth Podcast. Since January, I've brought you interviews with people from the world of British television. I'll be looking back at some of the best moments of the podcast so far. The first episode of the podcast went live in January, and I couldn't think of a better person to launch the podcast with than Erin Gordon, the launch director of Good Morning Britain and Peston. The question that everyone wanted me to ask him was about a certain Piers Morgan.
Piers is a really lovely guy, actually, and he will probably kill me for saying that, but no, do you know what? He's just a really passionate guy. He's a great journalist, and, you know, for me, he makes me better at my job each day because he challenges me, and you know, that's something that's, you know, that I love, and, you know, I like to be challenged. We're really lucky. We've got great presenters at Good Morning Britain, and, you know, all of them are at the top of their game.
My next guest on the podcast was Mark Lipscomb, a former continuity announcer for Thames Television and Carlton. He was also a newsreader for Central News South and Thames Valley Today. He spoke to me about the current state of television presentation, as well as a blooper where he was accidentally broadcast on air at the worst possible moment.
I love the new BBC Two look. I think that's a real refreshing look, and it's, you know, kept a stylized too. As for BBC One, oh gosh, what can you say about that? I just think for the national broadcaster, they are pretty awful. You know, understated, and nothingness. I don't know about oneness, but they're nothingness. I sort of get what they did. You know, oneness and bringing everyone together with BBC One. But that was okay for a short campaign, but it must be on for about 2 years now, surely.
It's just over 2 years now, yeah.
Is it? I mean, what was wrong with the Globe? It's just fabulous. You know, you can update it gradually. Bring back the Globe, I say, for BBC One. As the national broadcaster, bring back the Globe. We were in a programme in the afternoon, and suddenly we had a call from ITN to say that Laurence Olivier had died and that they would be doing a newsflash. Now, Laurence Olivier had done quite a lot of programmes for Thames over the latter years, so I was aware that the management, you know, were going to be upstairs watching this. But at the time when I was at Thames, we had talkback between the announcer and the presentation director, but it was keyed talkback, and by that I meant they pushed a button and you could hear them. We didn't wear earpieces or headphones. And we were in the middle of this programme, and I was sitting there, and suddenly over the talkback, my presentation director said, "We're doing a newsflash at ITN at, I think it was 3 o'clock, and we're going to be going to Trevor McDonald for a newsflash." And then suddenly the lights came on in the studio, and he said, "Coming to you, coming to you, coming to you." And suddenly I looked at my preview monitors and my transmission monitor, and I was on air.
Oh, dear.
And thinking, right, now, I remember he said, "We're going to ITN at 3 o'clock for the news flash." So I started talking, but nothing was coming out because they hadn't faded my microphone up.
Oh, dear.
So I'm sort of sitting there goldfishing, saying, and then suddenly they must have realised out in the control room, "Oh, my gosh, his microphone isn't up." So they put the microphone up. And I said, "We'll be joining Children's ITV in a couple of minutes. First, we're going over to ITN for a news flash." As it was at the time, a newsflash. Anyway, we went across to ITN. I think it was Trevor McDonald presenting the newsflash. By the time we switched over to ITN, my lights went out. And it was like, whew, what happened there? I must have looked like a frightened rabbit in the headlights. But by that time, my presentation director had been summoned upstairs to answer by management, "What the hell happened there?" And it was after that, because I said to them, if I'd have had an earpiece, I would have known what was going on. And after that, we had earpieces. So it's one of those days that you never forget. I've got the tape somewhere, and when I do find it, I'm sure there's plenty of people that would like to see it.
Graphic designer James Mobbs was the next guest to talk to me on the podcast. I spoke to him about his career and the thought process behind the recent relaunches of BBC Breakfast and Newsround.
Breakfast obviously moved in 2012, and it was sort of a hybrid of what had gone before, a bit fresher, different studio, much brighter. And then I think naturally, as any programme, I think all the output from the BBC in Salford had grown and developed since it'd been in Salford. And one thing that really surprised me is that we were really proud about being in Salford. We would have, you know, presenters out on the piazza. We'd use, you know, the environment around us. And also, I think a lot of the output was, you know, from Five Live and other parts of the BBC was really proud to be from Salford. And I was speaking to someone who works in audience research, and they were saying that, you know, a lot of people still don't realise the BBC is in the north, and a lot of output comes from the north. People associate it with still being in the south. So that started my brain thinking, oh, I wonder how we could change that. I wonder how we could, you know, be a bit louder and proud about coming from the north. And I think a lot of my team that I worked with at Breakfast, the editorial teams that I was reporting to, they agreed as well. And I think the starting point for me was, how could we reinterpret the titles and just give them a very subtle refresh? That's what I originally did. And I posted it on my Twitter, actually, a few weeks ago, just before I left the BBC. I was going through some old work, and I found it, and I thought, God, yeah, I forgot I did that. And it's weird to see, because I can see elements in that that then ended up with what's on air today. And that went down really well. But I think it's a case of, you know, there are a lot of decisions to go on the BBC, and, you know, you can't just decide you're going to change the graphics. It's you know, why are we doing it? Is, you know, there's a lot of editorial reasons and a lot of political decisions that are out of my control that we have to work with. So while I was pitching away to rebrand Breakfast, it was actually a bit of a slow burner, really. It was on a back burner until sort of end of 2017, beginning of 2018, when we really got going with it. I was very much sort of flying the flag of, you know, we should evolve the look all the time. I never believe that, you know, once I've done the Breakfast relaunch, that's Breakfast sorted. You know, I'm a believer in constant renewal and constant evaluation of on-air output. And I tried to do that across all the programmes I worked with at the BBC. In my staff job, it was Breakfast, Newsrounds and Northwest Tonight. And I was always looking for new ideas or new ways to do things, partly inspired by other channels that I was watching from around the world. You know, I'm a huge nerd. I'd look at TV Live, I'd look at TV Forum, I'd look at, you know, all those sort of websites, TV Newsroom, and look at all these international bits of presentation that I liked, and thought, that's quite a good idea. I wonder how we could, you know, interpret that, or how we could, you know, move that on into our programme. So it just came organically out of my own personality in that job, that I was someone who wanted to move things on quite a lot. And often that was just very informal conversations that then obviously when they become formal, that's when things become a little bit slower and harder to achieve.
I mean, it's a great little refresh, I have to admit. You've also worked on Newsround for many years.
Yes.
You did the relaunch a few years ago, and I understand you've done the forthcoming relaunch of Newsround.
Yes.
What was the thinking behind the changes?
Well, the original rebrand was probably one of the best things that I've ever worked on. It was great. It was really, I effectively went, well, it was all self-initiated again, similar to Breakfast. I went to the programme editor at the time and I said, I'd worked really hard to compile this audit of design that the audience of Newsround, it's aimed at 6 to 12-year-olds, that were, you know, all this design that they're exposed to on a daily basis, the type of design that's in the apps on their mum and dad's phone, the type of design that's on the bus shelter out, you know, when they get the school bus, the type of design that's on TV, the type of design that is on social media, the stuff they were seeing every day. And I felt really strongly that the Newsround design output at the time wasn't really hitting those points. And we also had, you know, a team of six designers who are all brilliant, but there were no sort of basic rules. We were using all sorts of different colors, all sorts of different typefaces. From one day to the next, there was no consistent language visually. And it was becoming more and more obvious when Newsround started to get more digital, put more stuff online. There was just no consistency. So I put this pitch together, and eventually they said, "Yeah, do you know what? That's a really good point. Let's give it a go." So all of our designers, all six of us, all pitched different ideas. We all got some time to work on our different thoughts, and then one of my bosses went to Newsround and pitched these ideas, and then I was chosen to work on it. So that's how the 2014 brand came around. And I remember thinking about my initial ideas. Actually, I've still got all my old, very early sketches and stuff. And I sort of wanted to create a brand that didn't feel too patronizing, that felt very cool and current, but also linked with BBC News. And I'm sure you probably know it has that sort of link with the David Lowe Music and the Globe and the what we call the Cradle, which is that sort of network of lines that connect the place names and the main BBC News titles. I sort of wanted to integrate those elements so it felt like a stepping stone to the core brand. And that came with not just sort of a nerdy perspective, but on a serious point, we were using BBC journalists from all around the world, whether it be Matthew Price, in Beijing or wherever it was, we were using the core news correspondents to put stuff together for Newsround as they were on location. And that was part of my reasoning of why we should link it to news, because it was a news program, it is a news program, and the agenda was newsy, and I think it only made sense to tie it with the master brand. And the great thing was that actually it was quite an open brief. I remember feeling very free and creative, and I could, there wasn't much to-ing and fro-ing in that process, which is incredibly rare. Even on the smallest of jobs, there was always a bit of to and fro of amends or changes, or should we change that wording, or is that quite the right shade? There was always, it's part of the design process, it always happens. And actually, we were a really great team. It was the program editor, the directors of Newsround, and myself who were working on the brand. And I think because it was quite a small team and we all felt involved and on the same page, it was a really lovely experience. And I approached David Lowe for the music. We got a brilliant set designer in called Emma Dibb, who worked on Bully Peter at the time. And our challenge there was we actually had to keep the video wall structurally. It was too expensive for us to change. So what could we do to really revamp that space, but actually not spending a lot of money? And yeah, I think she did a brilliant job making that space feel a lot bigger with the curved video wall. And the video wall actually was the same proportion and size and position, but by having these curved light boxes at the top and bottom, one, that was a reference to the core news studio, which I was very keen to include, but equally it made the space feel bigger because we rounded off those corners. And the Newsround studio itself is actually quite small. It's shared with CBBC presentation. I feel really proud that we managed to make a program look really consistent, really current, really newsy and bold and exciting. And even little things like the lights up, the lights down at the end of the start and end of the program. That's something that I was remembered from Newsround when I watched it in the sort of 90s. It had an element of excitement and pace and authority. And I wanted to bring all of that back to the brand because I felt like it sort of was not shouting proudly enough at the time. And, simple things like just standing up at the top of the bulletin and maybe for a softer story, we sit down. That sort of texture back into the programme was all considered and thought of as part of the brand. And I'm really proud of what we achieved. I think it really stood the test of time as well. The current refresh that's going to be on air in, I think, September. I've left the BBC now, so I'm not fully across things. That was all to do with digital. So early last year, we started working with some brilliant designers from BBC UX&D, which is user experience and design. And they were building a new digital experience for Newsround. And they identified similar problems that I had. Inconsistencies with output. You've got a range of producers and assistant producers and people making content, but there was no sort of consistent kit of parts for them to post a square video on Twitter. The website equally was not maybe as kid-friendly as it could have been. It was maybe a bit colourless, and I think a lot of the team felt that. So this team was brought in, and we worked together. I as sort of the director of the brand, had a chat with them, showed them to all the brand kit of parts, and it was quite scary, actually. It was the first time where I had to sort of let go of my baby, my brand. I had to sort of trust that they were going to do a good job. And they more than did a good job. They did an amazing job. They came back with this really beautifully refined and refreshed identity that didn't feel too distant from where Newsround currently was. They basically stripped out the globe and just had one of the little spacey orbs that flies around the globe and turned the colours into a gradient. It just felt more current. It was just an update 4 or 5 years on. And they applied that to the website, which launched in July last year. So that's, you know, it's sort of already launched on digital platforms. And as part of that, I designed a new digital kit of parts for social videos and stuff like that. And then it was very much a case of, right, now we need to update the TV side of things, because the studio screens, the templates that we use, the titles, they don't really look like the digital experience that kids are getting, the audience are getting online. So it was a case of then trying to get the funding and the sort of sign off on that happening. And I'm really proud of it. It's on my website now. I'm really proud of it. I think it looks great. I think it's a definite evolution of the brand. We also worked with an amazing guy called Dave Connolly, who works at Molecular Sound. And he's done a lot of the music for Sky Sports and for Challenge Idents and for loads of other TV projects. And I basically met him, and we had a bit of a chat about it. And I just said, look, I've got this bit of a brief. I'll just be interested to see how you respond to it. And he came back with this amazing chart current sound that had the core Newsround sound in it, but it also just felt 2019. And relevant to the audience. And that's how the new music came around. And you know, I worked with that music to then evolve the titles a little bit as well.
For months, I had been trying to get Mike Bushell as a guest on the TV Booth podcast. And I was absolutely delighted when he agreed to chat with me at the White Hart Pub in Overton in Hampshire. We spoke about a lot of things, his career, his wedding, and that moment at the Commonwealth Games.
Let me set the scene. It's a life-changing moment, really, because every morning during the Commonwealth Games, I was so lucky because we were doing the sport on breakfast live from the beach. So what would happen, you'd go live at 6 o'clock in the morning, British time, which would be 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Australian time. By then, a lot of the events of that day had happened, so you'd have medal winners. So I think it's called Producing Talent, this group over there from Team GB and Team England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, would bring any medal winners or gold medal winners to the beach to be interviewed. So they'd do Radio 5 Live, they'd do Hazel Irvine, BBC Sport, and they'd do breakfast. We'd all wait our turn. So you'd do the sport live, and then at some point, oh, we can go out. Tom Daly's just won gold in the diving. Here we are, Tom, hello. On the beach, beautiful setting at the sea, lapping at our feet, on the sand. That was our studio. On the Tuesday, I think it was, the 11th of April, we had a message at 6:25. In the morning, British time, 3:25 in the afternoon, Australian time, that the swimmers were stuck in traffic. We had six medal winners, five golds and one silver winner from Team England, all coming to be interviewed. So I remember their names, I remember what they'd achieved, but they weren't going to get to the beach. So they said, can you get to the swimming pool? Run up that road. So me and the cameraman called Rashid, we picked up his tripod and his camera and his live link, and we pelted it full pace up this road. It was now 28 minutes past six British time in the morning, past three in the afternoon Australian time. We walked into the swimming pool, and there were, on one side there were holidaymakers just at their hotel. It was a hotel pool. There was a camera team of about four or five from BBC Sport with Hazel Irvine, because they were doing the recorded interview for the main BBC One programme. And I was told in a whisper by one of the sport producers to sit around the other side of the pool and get ready, because after Hazel had finished, we could do them live on breakfast. Now, all I saw, there was one main pool where all the holidaymakers were sat around, and Hazel Irvine had all the swimmers sat around this little tiny kids pool, I thought, all of their feet in the water. They all had different microphones because they've got bigger budget, I guess, and so they all had different, their individual mics, stick mics. So I was on the other side of the pool. I got my shorts on. Thought, right, I can step into the water and interview them one by one, because I only had one mic, you see. And so I did the rest of the bulletin. And during the rest of the bulletin, I was moving closer and closer to where the swimmers were. And I was talking about the table tennis star from Wales. And Hazel still had moved. So I went, Hazel. When I was reading, just tapped her on the shoulder and gestured to her to finish. And she was very polite. She said, oh, God, yeah. So she got up just as I was coming to the end of reading about table tennis and saying, right now, we've got a very special moment here. We've got five swimmers sat by me in the pool. And I turned to them and I thought, well, I'll go along the line and interview them one by one with my one microphone. And they were just on the edge of the children's pool, I thought. So I stepped down, saying I have to be careful because of the mic pack. And I remember their names. I remember being so done so well that I remember their names. Yes. Yes, I got it. I got it, all their names. But then as I went to ask Sarah Vasey the first question, that's when I took a step to my right and didn't see the deep bit of the pool. And then went, way in slow motion down into the deep bit, trying to keep the microphone up and trying to pretend that it hadn't happened. So I sprang to my feet and apologised profusely, while everyone else around me just fell to the floor laughing. The swimmers sat there, but they were laughing. So I then had to position myself between Sarah Vasey's legs. It was very sort of quite a tight space, which was quite embarrassing, but she was just laughing. I got through the first question, she got through her first answer, and then kaboom, the microphone pack went. It oh, got dear. Wet. So they went to the weather, and then they came back when we had managed to borrow a plugged microphone that we could then go along. We actually then did the interview, but it was obviously by then other things were dominating. And apparently the editor back in Salford, who was editing that morning's programme, was first livid. What has just happened? Oh, my God, what's happened? Until a guy called James O'Hara outside pointed out, had she seen the social media reaction already within minutes? Within minutes, it had exploded. It was like going up all the time. Suddenly there were people on the phone from New Zealand, from China, from Uruguay, all over the world wanting to talk about it. Greg James rang up from Radio 1, had to go on his show that evening as well. It just went potty, but yeah, in a good way. I think because the swimmers took it in a good way.
My next guest was the TV and radio presenter Greg Scott. I have to say that from the start, this was one of the funniest interviews that I have ever done. One of the best moments of the interview was Greg describing a contestant on the late night ITV show Quizmania.
This was the magic of it for me. I had, you know, again, the industry will look at Quizmania. It was a phone-in quiz. Again, it's a genre that a lot of people will look down on. For me, it was the best presenting gig in the world, simply because it was live and you never knew what was going to happen. You never knew when that phone rang, who was going to be on the end of the phone, what state they were going to be in, and what they were going to say. And that for me is exciting. That is a thrill. But I suppose that the blooper as such, that you probably know the one I'm going to mention, was May from Scotland. She was the one who phoned up and just volunteered the information that she had no legs. I didn't test. There was, honestly, the answer, for those who don't know, we predetermined an answer on name a job in a hospital. And the answer that we predetermined was nurse. Oh, it was real brain-busting stuff, this, you know. But she went for doctor. She says, is it doctor? I said, no. And she said, just out of the blue, I think it's the doctor that cut my legs off. I have no legs. And it was just so left field. It was so out of the blue and unexpected. You know, okay, I'm hamming it up in being speechless. I'm hamming it up on camera. But I really was. I was, what do you say to that? What do you say? I mean, you know, do you try and make a joke of it? Do you try, you know, do you go, oh, sorry, and bring the whole thing down? And I just didn't know what to do. And that for me, I mean, that was just what, there was one guy who he admitted quite happily that he was smoking a spliff while he was talking to me. There was a Greek lady who was flirting, like, well, more than flirting with me. There was just my, and there was the, you know, because it was live, there was certain people. The guy who gave his answer as, well, it wasn't an answer. He just phoned up to say wanker. I think it was directed at me. I'm pretty sure it was directed at me, but again, it was one of those things that I couldn't deny. I can be from time to time. I admit it. But it would, no, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And when we got the call to go on ITV, that was extraordinary. No one expected it. But it happened. And we had a very, very, it was just an extraordinary few months. It really was.
As far as I'm concerned, no podcast dedicated to TV presentation would be complete without my next two guests. The first one of those was the legendary London Weekend Television announcer, Trish Bertram. In this portion of the podcast, I spoke to her about her career at BSB and Super Channel.
Late 80s, Super Channel set up. Once again, my time at LWT, I was still very much the junior in the 80s, which is fair enough. I wasn't doing very many shifts for them. I needed more experience. I wanted a job where I literally was plugged into the system, if you like, and working shifts, you know, more or less round the clock. And once I couldn't apply to the BBC because once you were tarnished with the ITV brush, the BBC wouldn't look at you. And Channel 4 weren't interested. It was literally the one thing I did find was that once you had cast your dive, you were known as an ITV person. It was very hard to cross over. You know, very, or if you were known as a BBC person, or if you were known, and Channel 4 obviously created their own sound. And this is in announcing terms. So I needed to go somewhere where I learnt more about what I was meant to be doing. And Super Channel launched, and I applied and did the audition, and they took me on. And it was extraordinary. It was an amazing time to work for Super Channel. We were based in the heart of London, back of Oxford Street. And mainly the workforce came from the BBC and a few of us from ITV. So the first thing that happened was there was kind of like a real, there was a communication problem because the BBC people, presentation people, had their own language and we had our own language as old ITVers. And so yeah. You know, you'd be in a corner going, what are they talking about? The symbol? Oh, you mean the ident? Oh, okay. You know? So there was a real language thing where, but in the end, we all kind of like shook down and became Super Channel people. And Super Channel should have been a success, really. It was launched as the best of British television for Europe. It was owned by everybody except Thames. I think Thames very wisely didn't take shares, but they owned a bit of the Astra satellite, if I remember, if memory serves. So they very cleverly didn't actually back the actual channel, but they backed the satellite. And everybody else kind of co-owned it. And therefore, our schedules were a real fantastic mix. And the BBC did a deal where they gave us a load of programming. So we had a mix of BBC and ITV programs, the best, you know, from the past and present. And we were meant to be this fabulous showcase for Europe of the best of British television. And guess what? Europe didn't give a toss. Didn't care. This amazing arrogance. I remember we were launched by Mrs. Thatcher and everything. Big launch party. Mrs. T rocks up, you know, says, here you are, Europe. We're all going to show you how marvellous we are. And there we all are thinking how marvellous we are. And they didn't give a toss. And that was the first big shock, was that nobody in Europe really cared about our wonderful British television satellite station. Which makes me laugh because that, once again, it was arrogance, Rob. It was just absolute arrogance that we thought we were so great, I think. And secondly, Equity, the Actors Union, threw our launch into disarray by not agreeing the actors' residuals. And therefore, most of the programmes had to be pulled from the schedule. And we ended up showing an awful lot of wildlife because tigers and lions don't need repeat fees. So that was that. That really screwed it. Now, your question about BSB. After 2 years at Super Channel, and it kind of went belly up, really. It got sold and passed along the line. And as every time it got sold off, for instance, Richard Branson bought it for £1 and promptly sacked half the workforce. So half of us got made redundant. And then it got sold on by him to an Italian media family called the Marcuccis. And they yanked it out of its home and we ended up in a basement in Molinare. It got, you know, and then it ended up being bought by NBC, the Americans, and off it went to Docklands. But along the way, it kept shedding people all the time. And so I knocked back on the door of London Weekend and went, my satellite adventure's gone a bit sort of, a bit, I was about to say tits up. Am I allowed to say that?
Not a problem.
My satellite adventure's gone a bit bleep up. And they said, oh, come back then. But well done you for going away and getting a bit more experience. And then a year later, an old boss of mine who had been associated with Super Channel, there's the link, he'd been our deputy head of prayers, and he went, do you fancy having another go? And I went, what do you mean? He went, well, I've got myself into another one. It's called British Satellite Broadcasting this time. Do you fancy coming and having a go at that one? I went, yeah, why not? So he said, I need a senior announcer. He said, I need someone who knows what they're doing, because we're going to hire lots of people who've never done it before to give it a different sound. He said, but we needed a couple of people around who kind of know how it runs. He said, come and have a go. And I went, yeah, okay. So off I went again, because I was always keen to learn something new. And I was always up for a new adventure. So off I went to BSB, which was, as we know, another big disaster. So good fun.
My final guest of the year was Trish's TV husband, Glenn Thompsett. I sat down with him to discuss his career in local radio before making the move to television. I spoke to him about the day that the Queen Mother died in 2002.
An hour into my shift, about 6 in the evening, we got a call through from ITN saying, on the talkback, saying that, you know, the Queen Mum has died. We need to hand over to ITN for what they used to call an open-ender, when ITN would just go on air and not sure what time they would come off. Hence, it was an open-ender. So at that point, I rang Trish back down in the bar. I said, look, Trish, Queen Mum's died. Any chance you could pop back? And we'll sort out what we're going to do for the evening. So as Trish mentioned on her podcast, when Diana died, it was a question of the announcers getting together with the head of presentation, the head of the departments, the transmission people, to really go through and reshape the output for the network. So it was up to us as the weekend nominated network contractor. Basically, we were in charge of the network for the weekend, and it was Thames or Carlton in the latter days during the week. So we were known as the nominated network contractor, and it was up to us to make those major decisions. So Trish came back, hurtling down the corridor, and she said, GT, what's happened? What's happened? And I obviously went through it, and we sat down with the paper schedule. You know, it was back in the days of paper schedules, a big, thick wadge of A4 tipped on its side, and that was our schedule. You know, every page had a different junction on it. All the ads were listed, the promos, the programs, the junctions, how long you had to speak. Latterly, it was obviously all one computer. It was computerised, so we knew exactly what we had to say, time slots we had to talk. And Trish and I and the transmission team, we literally rewrote the whole schedule for that evening, moved things around. Obviously, you have to go on air with a certain amount of reverence in your voice. You can't be too over the top. Bear in mind the news, what's happened, this awful news that the Queen Mum's died. I mean, she was a good age, but still, you know, a dreadful, dreadful shock when it does happen.
Follow the TV Booth podcast on Facebook, Twitter and YouTube for sneak previews of forthcoming podcasts.
Let's now return to our first guest, Aaron Gordon. One of the first questions I asked him was about Good Morning Britain and how it all came to be.
So I think that the brief was quite clear, and it was, so Neil Thompson, the editor, who asked me to be the series director of the programme, you know, they were very clear, and there was a clear message from the network that they wanted to do something different and something exciting. And I think that we wanted to sort of, we looked at, you know, successful breakfast shows around the world. And I think, you know, the most successful, you know, morning news magazine program, I would argue, is the Today program, the Today Show from NBC. And we looked at that, we looked at Good Morning America, we looked at some of the Australian shows, and we looked at our own shows as well, Daybreak, GMTV, all the things that people had tried before. We wanted to go back to sort of our roots, in that we wanted a bright and a warm and welcoming studio, but we wanted it to be different, which is why we put the desk in the middle of the studio. But we, you know, and we wanted to add a bit of energy back into it. I mean, I think one of the shows that has influenced me as well was the program, was the Big Breakfast on Channel 4. And I think, you know, they were phenomenal at what they did. And in many respects, I always think, you know, of Good Morning Britain as a bit like, I mean, it's a bit, I'm probably, you know, alone in thinking this, but it's a bit like, for me, it's like the Big Breakfast meets Sky News. And that's, you know, I love the sort of chaos of the Big Breakfast with the sort of the crew laughing and, you know, and you can have a giggle, you know, but then yeah. I love the fact that, you know, so I think we do that and we do that really well. And then I think we do news really well, actually, as well. And I think we've proved, you know, we had had RTS nominations last year for our coverage of Grenfell.
Yeah.
On breaking news. And I think we're really strong at covering breaking news. And the message I think was to sort of make that sort of show to a really, you know, lively, energetic morning news magazine program that wasn't sat on a red sofa for 3 hours. And that's not a dig. That's not a dig at GMTV, because I used to work on GMTV and it was an incredibly successful program. It's not a dig at BBC Breakfast either, because they do a cracking job at the program that they produce. They're just different programs for different audiences.
As James Mobbs is a graphic designer, I thought it would be a great idea to ask him what his favourite idents were.
I mean, where do I start? I mean, I remember loving, when I was younger, before I worked in TV, the BBC Three Blobs. I just loved their sort of irreverence and their comedy. The fact the clips were from, you know, old BBC archive audio. The original BBC Four idents are stunning. The BBC Two idents that are on air now are just beautiful. They're almost sort of mesmerizing and just hypnotic in many ways. They're totally hypnotic. And I think they're just beautiful pieces of art, aren't they, the current BBC Two identity. I love the previous BBC Two brand too, the fact it had so much personality in it. The current Channel 4 on-screen identity by DBLG is also iconic. I just love the fact that they've reinvented that iconic Lambinan logo from the 80s. And I don't know if you know this story, but I know Grant's talked about this, who's the design director of DBLG, quite a lot on blogs and in speeches he's done and talks, that, you know, they basically created a 3D model of the Channel 4 logo, got out of the blocks, and then just threw them on the table. And that's how they pitched this rebrand to Channel 4 of, you know, we can just, you know, just deconstruct that logo. And I just think that's brilliant. That sort of way of thinking is totally where I want to go in my career. And I just think that's such a refreshing outlook on the brand. I love the movement. I love the different colours. I love the new typeface, Horse Ferry and Chadwick. I just think it's a beautiful refresh of that brand. And then from a news perspective, one of the inspirations for me when I was working on the Newsround rebrand in 2014 was RTL News in the Netherlands. I don't know if you've seen that one. It's probably a bit niche.
Yeah.
But it's the one where it's got like really pippy music and sort of a very beautiful particle night sky or day sky, depending on what time of day it is. And what I love about that, and I think it's still on air now, still looks very fresh, was the use of colour. It was very primary. It was very bold. The hierarchy is just brilliant. It's nothing. I think the classic mistake that lots of people make as designers, I've done this myself too, I've only learned it, is, you know, think about that hierarchy. Does the title of this graphic need to be that big? Is the headline really that important? Is it breaking news? I think just think the on-screen grid they've got is really, really nice. Nothing is too bold. Nothing. It just is all at the right level, so it doesn't feel too overwhelming when you're watching it as a viewer. And I think their visual language is brilliantly executed across their daily graphics too. And that's one of the biggest challenges. When I did Newsround and rebranded that, it wasn't just here's some titles, here's the website logo, here's this, that, and the other. It's also how can we implement that brand across daily graphics? So when you've got other graphic designers that are covering those shifts, how can we make sure that they execute that brand consistently in a creative way that gives them freedom, but not, you know, but doesn't start looking totally like a different channel? And I think just their sort of infographic, bold, modern, contemporary, clean, sophisticated approach was a real big inspiration for me when doing Newsround. And I think that's one that stood the test of time. And interestingly, that designer, Mark Porter, he's the one that redesigned The Guardian way back in 2006-ish. So it's got that sort of, you know, Guardian-esque feel that's very sort of great. Basically, it uses colour brilliantly and it uses typography brilliantly. And I think because he was a print designer, that's where that hierarchy comes from. And hopefully, because I started off as a print designer, that's where my hierarchies come from. And then coming back to the UK, some other stuff I really love. And I went to ITV Creative to meet some of the guys there a few months ago, and I was talking about how much I loved their flow. When they've relaunched in 2013 with the logo they've got now, the flow between in trail, bumper, ident into a program, it was just so seamless and beautiful. There was no sort of black frames, or I was like, how on earth did you achieve that? It was just seamless, because there's always, whenever you deliver something into all these different systems that are in broadcast chains, there are always little discrepancies. So something might fall a pixel out, or something might jump, or there's, I know from my experience, trying to get different systems to look and flow simultaneously, it's really hard. And I just love the fact they had this beautiful flow between an ITV trail to an ITV2 trail to an ITV3 trail to an ident to a brake bumper into an ad. It was just beautifully executed. And yeah, I'd love to work on a channel brand in the future where I can have a similar approach and try and create a real flow between that on-screen architecture. I don't think any other channels, I've never really seen any other channel nail it as well since. I think BBC Two is quite slick with the, you know, how the trails come in and out and then it goes to an ident. I think that's probably as close as we've got so far, but one day I'd like to try and beat that sort of brilliant smooth flow of ITV on a channel rebrand.
One of the topics I spoke to Mark Lipscomb about was his role on the day of the September the 11th terrorist attacks. Mark was the duty continuity announcer that day and had to announce several schedule changes.
Well, I have to say, Rob, I always liken the job of an announcer and a presenter, actually. You have to be very much like a swan. You're very calm and cool on the surface. Underneath, your feet could be paddling like mad because all around you is changing. And that's, I have to say, that's when an announcer and a presenter earns their money, when things are changing at such a fast pace. And I remember I was at home on the day of 9/11 during the daytime and just getting ready actually to leave to go to work. And I had my television on and saw, you know, the dreadful goings on with the Twin Towers, and obviously got to work as quick as I could. Because it was an unfolding situation and things were changing so rapidly. You know, ITN were doing, as they called it, open ender, whereby they go on air and just carry on until, you know, they've given as much information as possible. But at the same time, the schedule was changing in other ways. So it was changing as we were on air, which was great. And so what we had to do was a lot of network announcements at the time. We would have a 30-second rundown saying, you know, due to circumstances and events in America today, program changes are like this, and that means we're going to be joining ITN at such a time. And that's when the adrenaline, you know, rushes through your veins, and that's when you really earn your money, because you've really got to be on the ball. And it was, I have to say, like that when Diana, Princess of Wales died. You know, big events changes everything in television, and you've got to be prepared and you've got to deliver. You know, that's the main thing. So it was exciting because, you know, I also remember being on at Thames when the first Gulf War started. And that was just incredible, because my controller presentation came in late at night, and they were literally rewriting the ITV schedule as they were going along. And, you know, they were doing lives into ITN. And it's when you see that part of the ITV machinery kicking in, you just think, wow, this is something really quite special. Because at times like that, you know, they deliver and they're there for the public to know what's going on. And you just, at the time, I stood back and I thought, this is just incredible to watch this.
You've heard Mike Bushell talking about that embarrassing moment at the Commonwealth Games. Now an embarrassing moment about something that happened at his wedding 3 weeks prior to recording this podcast.
I really didn't know what to expect. So my university mates from Winchester, from King Alfred's, actually. We weren't good enough to go to university, I have to point that out. It was King Alfred's College at the time. It is now Winchester University, but at the time it was King Alfred's College back in the 80s. Great mates who now various live in London, probably, and one lives in Bath. They clubbed together very kindly. A big surprise at the end of the... well, at the start of the party in the evening, they just came out with this present tandem, which they put together up at Oakley Hall. And, of course, we had to get on it straight away. We rode around the gravel at Oakley Hall. It became a bit of a sporting event because lots of other people never go. But actually, fair play to Emily. She had a bride's dress on still.
Oh, blimey.
And her mother, Angela Bond, from Overton, ran along behind holding the bridal dress up. So then for the rest of the evening, during the party, a couple of other people had a go. They're quite challenging. You've never been on a tandem. You can do it, but you do need to get into sync.
Yeah, you have to.
And so a few people took it for spins, and then it got put to a side when it got dark and people were dancing away. And then being the host, well, not the host, but being... Actually, I hadn't had much to drink all day because you don't eat your own wedding, do you? So I was keen for the party to go on after one. And so I sat chatting to a few people, actually from another party, and Simon, the great landlord for this wonderful pub,
the assistant manager of this pub.
Assistant manager, yeah, indeed. So, yeah, yes. Nick and Simon.
Nick and Simon, of course. Yeah.
Assistant manager, I mean, yes, we all had a few, and it was about 3 a.m, and Emily and I, we'd had enough. We decided time to go to bed. And so Simon carried on having a tipple with friend Gemma and her friend. And I think Simon, I do remember Simon saying to me, oh, I don't know how I'll get back. I said, well, he said, I might borrow your tandem. There's no way he'd get on tandem. On his own? He can ride those dark lanes all the way to Oakley from here. Sorry, Overton from Oakley. But he said, don't worry, if it's not here in the morning, check with the White Hart. So sure enough, the next morning at Oakley Hall, I asked the owner up there, well, one of the help, the bar managers, where's the tandem? Well, we can't find it. It has disappeared. So I telephoned the White Hart, and Nick said, yes, it's here. It's here. Yes, your college mates who stayed here last night, they've been laughing the fact that it's here this morning. But it's a bit worse for wear. So there's two ways of looking at this, really. Yes, Simon did end up in a ditch. And there's a brake broken, a mudguard came off, and a spoke missing. Well, a spoke came out. But it's still rideable. It's going to get repaired, but the back brake still works. You can still ride it around. The middle saddle's a bit wonky, but... things you can live with. But the fact is, hats off to him, he managed to ride all the way back from Oakley to Overton, which is what, 4 miles, on a tandem which is built for two, which is quite heavy, no lights, but I guess it might have been night anyway, this time of year. It might, so let's say it was light.
Let's say it was light.
5 o'clock in the morning.
And
maybe he got hit, taken out by a crow or something, or a buzzard.
Probably.
Early morning.
Probably.
I don't know which ditch he ended up in, but he got back safely. That's the main thing. That's all I care about, is that our good assistant manager from this wonderful pub came back safely in one piece.
I should just point out that Simon was absolutely mortified at breaking it and has offered to pay for the damage.
He's a great guy. We all love him, and he's a great friend. So, no, it's more important to me that he was in one piece.
Absolutely.
In the bike. The bike's fine. It's a good story as well. Attached to the bike forevermore.
Oh,
it's
absolutely. Legendary. Absolutely.
Overton legend.
Absolutely.
We come back from a lunch break, and I was just walking around the back of the set, and I could see there was this gap, there was this hole you could get your hand down. So I thought, oh, that's got to be done. So I suggested to John, the producer, I said, John, you know, there's a chance here for some TV gold. Why don't we do it? So I explained my idea, and he said, okay. So, occasionally there's pickups on Countdown, there's retakes. So we told Carol, or they told Carol, we just got to do retake the first few letters from a letters game. So that's what they did. Said it was going to be a retake, and then bam, grabbed her hand, and then she was peeled off the ceiling. She never really forgave me. Never really. I tell you what, there's a lovely story with this. It made a program in America called The World's Greatest Ever TV Bloopers, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And one day, about 2 years after this happened, Carol came up to me in the studio and she said, this is for you. She handed me an envelope. had no idea what it was, no idea. So I opened it, and there was a cheque for £400. I said, what's this? And she said, well, you know that what you did to me? I said, yeah. She said, well, it's been on this show in America, and they sent me the royalties, and it's only fair that you had half of it.
Trish Bertram was the continuity announcer on the day of the death of Princess Diana in 1997. Here she is to tell us exactly what happened on that day.
I had done the late shift the night before, Friday night, and that meant I was home by 1 a.m. I think, yeah, our shifts finished about 1, even though the telly sort of carried on through the night. And I'd been up to about 2, because when you come off a shift, you are always wide awake for about an hour by the time you get home. And so I got to bed very late. And in the morning, about 8 a.m, I dimly heard my phone ringing. And my other half got up, answered the phone, and I could hear this kind of like murmuring of voices. And he came in and he said to me, you've got to get up and go to work. And I went, I did the late. Don't. I was on late. And he said, no, you've got to go to work. It's Lucy, your boss on the phone. Your boss is on the phone. Lucy's on the phone. So I get out of bed and I go to the phone and she says, Trish, you've got to come in. Princess Diana has been, Princess Diana has died. And I went, oh. And I'd dimly been aware that there'd been some news footage the night before. There'd been a kind of like a news headlines thing. And I'd looked at it the night before and it just said she'd been taken to hospital. I remember they said there'd been a crash in a tunnel in Paris and she'd been taken to hospital. And I remember thinking, oh, she'll be okay. They're not reporting she's died or anything. She'll be okay. Because you have to be, as an announcer, very aware of news events, as I'm sure you realize, because it affects you. And I'd remember. I remember thinking that the night before. Okay, she's gone to hospital. That's fine. I can go to bed now. It's all going to be fine. So my boss said, get in. So I get dressed and I stumble into work on very little sleep. Because we had hired that day, we had a freelance on duty for the early shifts. And it's not fair to actually ask a freelance person to handle something like that. You have to put on someone who represents the company. And I was staff at this point. So in I go. And our lovely freelancer, remember, it was David Bradford. Famous David Bradford, who a QVC legend, he was freelancing for us and he became our gopher and our runner that day. And he was sterling work because we needed someone just to keep the cups of tea going. Yeah. In we go. And literally, television is run by the split second. You know, there is a schedule that absolutely maps out television presentation to the second. And you go in and you know you're about to tear up the schedule for the whole day. That is scary. Literally from 1 hour to the next. We did not know what we were going to do. So all the control rooms are linked up by a red phone. So the red phone connects up. Everybody's speakers are up, so you can hear all the other inputs from all the other control rooms. So if you imagine, it's like a mass conference call of all the control rooms. Everybody is deciding what's going on. The big execs go in, come in. The top execs decide hour by hour. So Granada, Carlton... London Weekend, they decide. So what was happening was things like, if I remember now, was it Anglia said, well, we're due to do a live, what was it they were due to do? We're due to do a live, blah, 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 blah. We'll take that out and we'll turn it into how is this affecting you program. Somebody else said, well, we're due to do this, but what if we run that? ITN are on the line going, we've got the obit ready. Maybe we ought to put that there. And they literally plan the schedule from hour to hour. So while they're doing that, the presentation managers are planning the junctions and going, okay, so we'll have 340 there, we'll have this there, this there, this there. And that's all filtering down over the red phone. So I'm sitting in the London Weekend control room with one of the promo guys. We're working out what our slots are from all the information coming in. So we're going to get 30 there, 30 there, 30 there. And I then am writing on the fly what I hope is suitable explanation as to why our schedules have gone out the window, the sad thing that's happened, and what is happening for our viewers. And so I don't know if I've explained that at all well, but all I remember is we flew by the seat of our pants that day, and we literally filled in hour by hour, junction by junction, and I wrote it as I went, and hopefully sounded suitably somber, because it was sad and was shocking, and nobody quite knew what was going on that day. So yeah, it was the day we all earned our money. It really was. And that was the first time we were fed to the network, I think, London Weekend.
Both Trish and Glenn Thompson were the final continuity announcers for London Weekend Television. In 2002, they made their final announcements for the station. Here they are talking about how they knew that LWT was coming to an end and what they did to mark the end of an era.
Well, Rob, it was so sad. It was such a very, very sad occasion. We knew it was coming. We knew that the mighty Granada machine was rumbling into town, and we knew the writing was on the wall. But when it actually came, it was a shock. Lucy Booth, our head of department, she took Trish and I out for a bite to eat, told us what was going to happen, said that you're going to have the option to take redundancy. We'll train you. You can have a bit of money to go off and train for something else, which they duly did, which was great. I went off and did a bit of web design, got a certificate for that, for various things to do with the web. And it was great use of money. I also went on a broadcast journalist law course, used the money for that as well, because at that time I wasn't doing news. I'd been working in programme presentation. I was a DJ on the radio. I was a jock, rambling up to the vocals on songs. I was very much a pop and prattle jock in my early days of radio. And then I later became involved in news. And so I went off and did a law course for broadcast journalism. And Trish and I basically sat down with Lucy, and Lucy told us that, you know, in October 2002, the whole jolly journey is going to come to a grinding halt. And it was incredibly sad. And I'm sure you can remember this.
Well, things will be a little different from tomorrow, won't they, Trish?
They certainly will, Glenn. From tomorrow, ITV1 will be coming at you with a whole new look, which means, sadly, this is where you and I bow out.
It certainly is, but it's been fun though, Trish.
It's been many years, Glenn.
So, for the final time,
from our studios on the South Bank,
this is LWT,
London Weekend Television.
So that was a link that we did envision. Gareth Randall, who was in the promotions department at London Weekend Television, Lucy, myself, Trish, load of other people, thought we've got to go out in style. We need to do something to see off this iconic broadcasting company.
Our immediate boss, Lucy, our presentation manager, basically got in touch with Glenn and I, my TV husband, as I call him, wonderful Glenn Thompson, and said, I'd like to take you both out to lunch. And we went, uh-oh. You know, whenever your boss rings up all happy and cheerful and says, I'm going to take you both out to lunch, you know it's not going to be good. And of course, we'd heard rumblings, Rob. You know, we'd seen the way things were going. You know, the promo department had become the network promotions unit. You know, so all the promo departments around the network had all been amalgamated into one. You know, the control rooms were all being amalgamated. More and more of it was disappearing as the big companies swallowed each other up. So we kind of knew that maybe our day would come. So our boss took us out to lunch locally in Waterloo and sat us down and said, at the end of this year, this was around, I think, maybe it was August or September, and she said, at the end of the year, this is going to, a bit later on, this is going to be happening and pretty soon, within weeks. And I'm just giving you a bit of warning, and there will be, we're going to, you know, it's going to launch as ITV. There will be opportunities for you to apply if you wish to join the network team, but obviously this will be thrown open to all the announcers around the network, which is only fair and proper, which it is. And and if you don't choose to apply and you don't follow ITV into the future, then obviously we will be discussing redundancy packages with you, because you've both been here a long time now. And that's how we found out. We were taken out and told. So, and we were both very sad.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because we loved LWT. I mean, LWT was just the best, you know, the best experience ever, really. It was just such a great company to work for.
But I have to admit, the final weekend of broadcasting as LWT was heaven for us presentation fans, especially the final day when you brought back all the old idents and it even had a startup sequence.
I'm going to claim all credit for it now, because it was all my idea, and I just want that on record now.
Actually, whose idea was it?
It was mine, because now what you've got to remember is, bit by bit, various sort of managements were being let go or out the door. We were a rudderless ship by the time it was approaching the start of ITV, because Granada had bought us, and Granada, the Granada management were really not sort of in force. The old LWT management were out the door. Our bosses were disappearing. There was only Lucy left, our immediate manager, keeping it all going. And I said to her, you know, we can't just disappear off air without marking this. This station, this company is something extraordinary. You know, we've been a pioneering company here. Can't we do something? And she said, well, it better not involve money, because they won't give us any money. And so I went to wonderful Gareth Randall. Hi, Gareth, if you're listening. Who was one of our promo producers, who is part of the TV history community, I know, and highly thought of. And I said, Gareth, you know, any chance? He said, leave it with me. And he went to Dave Jeffries, who is his mate, who is a fabulous graphics person and part of the TV history community. And he said to him, you could do us a favor. And so Gareth got together a little group of people and said, right, we will recreate all this. So I very much am grateful. And Lucy, our boss, was completely compliant and said, right, what do you need? What do you need? And so between a little gaggle of us, we decided we were going to mark the demise of this station all off our own bat, because there was no one senior to tell us not to. And Gareth came down with a video camera and shot that little thing, which lives on YouTube to this day. So it was all slung together by the goodwill and grace of a handful of people who said, yes, I'll help you do that. And that's how these things are done. I think people always think that, you know, these things are planned at high level in boardrooms. They're not. It's usually a handful of people at the coalface going, hey, why don't we do that? Why don't we do this? And someone saying, yes, you can. And that was my immediate boss, Lucy Booth, who is thanked, I think, on the final plaque. I says, thanks to Lucy Booth, because Lucy was the only presentation manager in charge at that point. Because no, as the companies wound down, nobody really cared about us. Everyone was getting ready for ITV. You know, get ready for ITV. Oh, do you remember that? That was back in the day. That's how it happened. And as I say, I'm totally taking credit, because it was my idea to sort of say, come on, everyone, I think we need to do this. And what can we do? And what's possible? So.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this special compilation looking back at the best bits of the TV Booth podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll be back with new episodes in the new year. For now, though, from me, Rob Francis, goodbye.
The TV Booth podcast is hosted by Rob Francis. Copyright 2019. I think that'll do.